If you've done it once already, and you know damn well what it's going to feel like to have to do it again.
He turned away without waiting for my response, and rode into the dooryard, scattering a flock of foraging doves. He sat his horse upright, his shoulders broad and square. There was no hint of the deep-webbed scars that lined his back beneath the homespun cloak, but I knew them well. So that was it, I thought. As in water, face answereth to face, so the heart of man to man. And the law of courage was the one he had lived by for the longest. Several chickens huddled on the porch, fluffed into balls of yellow-eyed resentment. They muttered balefully among themselves as we dismounted, but were too cold to do more than shuffle away from us, reluctant to abandon their patch of sunshine. Several boards of the porch itself were broken, and the yard nearby was littered with scraps of half-hewn lumber and scattered nails, as though someone had meant to mend it, but hadn't yet found a moment to attend to the job. The procrastination had lasted for some time, I thought. The nails were rusty, and the newly cut boards had warped and split with damp.
"Oh, the house!" Jamie shouted, stopping in the centre of the dooryard.
This was accepted etiquette for approaching a strange house. While most people in the mountains were hospitable, there were not a few who viewed strangers warily, and were inclined to make introductions at gunpoint until the caller's bona fides should be established. With this in mind, I kept a cautious distance behind Jamie, but made sure I was visible, ostentatiously spreading my skirts and brushing them down, displaying my gender as evidence of our peaceable intent. Damn! There was a small hole burned through the brown wool, no doubt from a flying campfire spark. I concealed the burn spot in a fold of skirt, thinking how odd it was that everyone regarded women as inherently harmless. Had I been so inclined, I could easily have burgled houses and murdered hapless families from one end of the ridge to the other. Fortunately, the impulse to do so hadn't struck me, though it had dawned on me now and then that the Hippocratic Oath and its injunction to do no harm might not have strictly to do with medical procedure. I'd had the impulse to dot one of my more recalcitrant patients over the head with a stick of firewood more than once, but had so far managed to keep the urge in check. Of course, most people hadn't the advantage of a doctor's jaundiced view of humanity. And it was true that women didn't go in so much for the recreational sorts of mayhem that men enjoyed. I rarely found women beating each other into pulp for fun. Give them a good motive, though, and... Jamie was walking toward the barn, shouting at intervals, to no apparent effect. I glanced round, but there were no fresh tracks in the dooryard save our own. A scatter of dung balls lay near the half-hewn log, but those had plainly been left days ago. They were moist with dew, but not fresh. Most had crumbled to powder. No one had come. No one had gone, save on foot. The Beardsleys, whoever and however many of them there were likely still within. Lying low, though. It was early, but not so early that farm folk wouldn't already be about their chores. I had seen someone earlier, after all. I stepped back and shaded my eyes against the rising sun, looking for any sign of life. I was more than curious about these Beardsleys, more than slightly apprehensive about the prospects of having one or more male Beardsley riding with us, given recent events. I turned back to the door and noticed an odd series of notches cut into the wood of the jamb. Each one was small, but there were a great many, running the complete length of one doorpost and halfway down the other. I looked closer. They were arranged in groups of seven, a scant width of unscarred wood between the groups, as a prisoner might count, keeping track of the weeks. Jamie emerged from the barn, followed by a faint bleating. The goats he'd mentioned, of course. I wondered whether it had been Keziah's job to milk them. If it was, his absence was going to become rapidly apparent, if it wasn't already. Jamie took a few paces toward the house, cupped his hands round his mouth, and shouted again. No answer. He waited a few moments, then shrugged and strode up onto the porch, where he hammered on the door with the hilt of his dirk. It made enough noise to wake the dead, had there been any in the vicinity, and sent the chickens squawking away in a feather-scattering panic. But no one appeared in answer to the thunderous summons. Jamie glanced back at me, one eyebrow raised. People didn't normally go off and leave their farms untended, not if they had livestock.
"Someone's here," he said in answer to the unvoiced thought. "The goats are fresh milked. There are drops still on their teats."
"Do you think they could all be out searching for, you know who?" I murmured, moving closer to him.
"Perhaps."
He moved to the side, bending to peer into a window. It had once been glassed, but most of the panes were cracked or missing, and a sheet of ratty muslin had been tacked over the opening. I saw Jamie frown at it, with a craftsman's disdain for a shoddy repair. He turned his head suddenly, then looked at me.
"Do you hear something, Sassenach?"
"Yes. I thought it was the goats, but..." The bleat came again, this time unmistakably from the house. Jamie set his hand to the door, but it didn't budge.
"Bolted,"
he said briefly, and moved back to the window, where he reached carefully into the frame and pulled loose a corner of the muslin cloth. "Phew," I said, wrinkling my nose at the air that wafted out. I was used to the odours of a winter-sealed cabin, where the scents of sweat, dirty clothes, wet feet, greasy hair, and slop jars mingled with baking bread, stewing meat, and the subtler notes of fungus and mould. But the aroma within the Beardsley residence went well beyond the norm. "Either they're keeping pigs in the house," I said, with a glance at the barn, "or there are 10 people living in there who haven't come out since last spring."
"That's a bit ripe," Jamie agreed.
He put his face into the window, grimacing at the stink, and bellowed,
"Tigamach, come out, Beardsley, or I'm coming in."
I peered over his shoulder to see whether this invitation might produce results. The room within was large, but so crowded that scarcely any of the stained wooden floor was visible through the rubble. Sniffing cautiously, I deduced that the barrels I saw contained, among other things, salt fish, tar, apples, beer, and sauerkraut, while bundles of woolen blankets dyed with cochineal and indigo, kegs of black powder and half-tanned hides reeking of dog turds lent their own peculiar fragrances to the unique mephitis within. Beardsley's trade goods, I suppose. The other window had been covered as well, with a tattered wolf hide, so that the interior was dim and shadowy. With all the boxes, bundles, barrels and bits of furniture lying in heaps, it looked like a poverty-stricken version of Ali Baba's cave. The sound came again from the back of the house, somewhat louder, a noise midway between a squeal and a growl. I took a step back, sound and acrid smell together vividly recalling an image of dark fur and sudden violence. "Bears," I suggested, half seriously. "The people are gone and there's a bear inside."
"Aye, Goldilocks," Jamie said very dryly. "Ne doot. Bears or not, there's something wrong. Fetch the pistols and cartridge box from my saddlebag."
I nodded and turned to go, but before I could step off the porch, a shuffling noise came from inside, and I turned back sharply. Jamie had grasped his dirk, but as he saw whatever was inside, his hand relaxed on the hilt. His eyebrows also rose in surprise, and I leaned over his arm to see. A woman peered out from between two hillocks of goods, looking round suspiciously, like a rat peering out of a garbage dump. She wasn't particularly rat-like in appearance, being wavy-haired and quite stout, but she blinked at us in the calculating way of vermin, reckoning the threat.
"Go away,"
she said, evidently concluding that we were not the vanguard of an invading army.
"Good morning to you, ma'am," Jamie began. "I am James Fraser of..." "I don't care who you are," she replied. "Go away." "Indeed I will not," he said firmly. "I must speak with the man of the house."
An extraordinary expression crossed her plump face. Concern, calculation, and what might have been amusement.
"Must you?" she said.
She had a slight lisp. It came out as "must you."
"And who says you must?"
Jamie's ears were beginning to redden slightly, but he answered calmly enough.
"The governor, madam. I am Colonel James Fraser," he said with emphasis, "charged with the raising of militia. All able-bodied men between the ages of 16 and 60 are called to muster. Will you fetch Mr. Beardsley, please?"
"Militia, is it?"
she said, handling the word with care.
"Why? Who will you be fighting, then?"
"With luck, no one. But the call to muster is sent out. I must answer, and so must all able-bodied men within the treaty line."
Jamie's hand tightened on the cross-piece of the inner frame and rattled it experimentally. It was made of flimsy pine sticks, the wood shrunken and badly weathered. He could plainly rip it out of the wall and step through the opening if he chose to do so. He met her eyes straight on and smiled pleasantly. She narrowed her eyes and pursed her lips, thinking.
"Able-bodied men," she said at last. "Well, we've none of those. The bond lad's run off again, but even if he were here, he's not able. Deaf as that doorpost and quite as dumb."
She nodded toward the door in illustration.
"If you care to hunt him down, you're welcome to keep him, though."
It didn't look as though there would be any hue and cry after Keziah then. I took a deep breath in a sigh of relief, but let it out again swiftly. Jamie wasn't giving up easily.
"Is Mr. Beardsley in the house?" he asked. "I wish to see him."
He gave an experimental tug on the frame and the dry wood cracked with a sound like a pistol shot.
"He's scarce fit for company," she said,
and the odd note was back in her voice, wary, but at the same time filled with something like excitement.
"Is he ill?"
I asked, leaning over Jamie's shoulder. "I might be able to help. I'm a doctor." She shuffled forward a step or two and peered at me, frowning under a heavy mass of wavy brown hair. She was younger than I'd thought. Seen in better light, the heavy face showed no cobweb of age or slackening of flesh.
"A doctor?"
"My wife's well kent as a healer," Jamie said. "The Indian folk call her White Raven."
"The conjure woman?"
Her eyes flew wide in alarm and she took a step back. Something struck me odd about the woman, and looking at her, I realized what it was. Despite the reek in the house, both the woman's person and her dress were clean, and her hair was soft and fluffy, not at all the norm at this time of year, when people generally didn't bathe for several months in the cold weather.
"Who are you?"
I asked bluntly. "Are you Mrs. Beardsley? Or perhaps Miss Beardsley?" No more than 25, I thought, in spite of the bulk of her swaddled figure. Her shoulders swelled fatly under her shawl, and the width of her hips brushed the barrel she stood between. Evidently, trade with the Cherokee was sufficiently profitable to keep Beardsley's family in adequate food, if not his bond servants. I eyed her with some dislike, but she met my gaze coolly enough.
"I am Mrs. Beardsley."
The alarm had faded. She pursed her lips and pushed them in and out, regarding me with an air of calculation. Jamie flexed his arm and the window frame cracked loudly.
"Come you in, then?"
The odd tone was still in her voice, half defiance, half eagerness. Jamie caught it and frowned, but released his grip on the frame. She moved out from between the boxes and turned toward the door. I caught no more than a glimpse of her in motion, but that was enough to see that she was lame. One leg dragged, her shoe scraping on the wooden floor. There was a bumping and grunting as she fumbled with the bolt, a grating noise, and then a thunk as she dropped it on the floor. The door was warped, stuck in its frame. Jamie put his shoulder to it, and it sprang loose and swung in, boards quivering with the shock. How long since it had been opened, I wondered. A good long time, evidently. I heard Jamie snort and cough as he went in, and did my best to breathe through my mouth as I followed. Even so, the smell was enough to knock a ferret over. Beyond the reek of the goods, there was an outhouse smell from somewhere. Stale urine and a ripe fecal stench. Rotting food, too, but something else besides. My nostrils twitched cautiously as I tried to inhale no more than a few molecules of air for analysis. "How long has Mr. Beardsley been ill?" I asked. I had picked out a distinct stench of sickness amid the general fetor. Not only the ghost of long-dried vomit, but the sweet smell of purulent discharge and that indefinable, musty, yeast-rising odour that seemed to be simply the smell of illness itself. "Oh, some time." She shut the door behind us, and I felt a sudden surge of claustrophobia. Inside, the air seemed thick, both from the stench and from the lack of light. I had a great impulse to rip down the coverings from both windows and let in a little air, and clenched my hands in the fabric of my cloak to keep from doing it. Mrs. Beardsley turned sideways and scuttled crab-like through a narrow passageway left between the stacks of goods. Jamie glanced at me, made a Scottish noise of disgust in his throat, and ducked under a jutting bundle of tent poles to follow her. I made my way cautiously after, trying not to notice that my foot fell now and then on objects of an unpleasant squashiness. Rotten apples? Dead rats? I pinched my nose and didn't look down. The farmhouse was simple in construction. One big room across the front, one behind. The rear room was a striking contrast to the squalid clutter of the front. There was no ornament or decoration. The room was plain and orderly as a Quaker meeting hall. Everything was bare and spotless. The wooden table and stone hearth scrubbed to rawness, a few pewter utensils gleaming dully on a shelf. One window here had been left uncovered, glass intact, and the morning sun fell across the room in pure white radiance. The room was quiet and the air still, increasing the odd feeling that we had entered a sanctuary of some sort from the chaos of the front room. The impression of peace was dispelled at once by a loud noise from above. It was a sound we had heard earlier, but close at hand, a loud squeal filled with desperation like a tortured hog. Jamie started at the sound and turned at once toward a ladder at the far side of the room, which led upward to a loft. "Hear that there?" Mrs. Beardsley said, unnecessarily, as Jamie was already halfway up the ladder. The squealing noise came again more urgently, and I decided not to fetch my medicine box before investigating. Jamie's head appeared at the top of the ladder as I grasped it. "Bring a light, Sassenach," he said briefly, and his head vanished. Mrs. Beardsley stood motionless, hands buried in her shawl, making no effort to find a light. Her lips were pressed tight together, her plump cheeks mottled with red. I pushed past her, seized a candlestick from the shelf, and knelt to light it at the hearth before hastening upward. "Jamie?" I poked my head above the edge of the loft, holding my candle cautiously above my head.
"Here, Sassenach."
He was standing at the far end of the loft, where the shadows lay thickest. I scrambled over the top of the ladder and made my way toward him, stepping gingerly. The stench was much stronger here. I caught the gleam of something in the dark and brought the candle forward to see. Jamie drew in his breath, as shocked as I was, but quickly mastered his emotion.
"Mr. Beardsley, I presume," he said.
The man was enormous, or had been. The great curve of his belly still rose whale-like out of the shadows, and the hand that lay slack on the floorboards near my foot could have cupped a cannonball with ease. But the flesh of the upper arm hung slack, white, and flabby, the massive chest sunken in the centre. What must once have been the neck of a bull had wasted to stringiness, and a single eye gleamed, frantic behind strands of matted hair. The eye widened, and he made the noise again, his head straining upward urgently. I felt a shudder go through Jamie. It was enough to raise the hair on the back of my own neck, but I disregarded it, pushing the candlestick into Jamie's hands. "Hold the light for me." I sank to my knees, too late feeling the liquid ooze through the fabric of my skirt. The man lay in his own filth, and had been lying so for quite some time. The floor was thick with slime and wet. He was naked, covered by no more than a linen blanket, and as I turned it back, I glimpsed ulcerated sores amid the smears of ordure. It was clear enough what ailed Mr. Beardsley. One side of his face sagged grotesquely, the eyelid drooping, and both the arm and the leg on the near side of his body splayed limp and dead. The joints left knobby and weirdly distorted by the falling away of the muscle around them. He snuffled and bleated, tongue poking and slobbering from the corner of his mouth in his vain but urgent attempts at speech. "Hush," I said to him. "Don't talk. It's all right now." I took the wrist to check his pulse. The flesh moved loosely on the bones of his arm, with not the slightest twitch of response to my touch. "A stroke," I said softly to Jamie. "An apoplexy, you call it." I put my hand on Beardsley's chest to offer the comfort of touch. "Don't worry," I said to him. "We've come to help." I spoke reassuringly, though even as I said the words, I wondered what help was possible. Well, cleanliness and warmth, at least. It was nearly as cold in the loft as it was outside, and his chest was chilly and pebbled with goose flesh among the bushy hair. The ladder creaked heavily, and I turned to see the outline of Mrs. Beardsley's fluffy head and heavy shoulders, silhouetted by the light from the kitchen below. "How long has he been like this?" I asked sharply. "Perhaps a month," she said, after a pause. "I couldn't move him," she said defensively. "He is too heavy." That was plainly true. However...
"Why is he up here?" Jamie demanded. "If you didn't move him, how did he get here?"
He turned, shedding the light of the candle over the loft. There was little here that would draw a man. An old straw mattress, a few scattered tools, and bits of household rubbish. The light shone on Mrs. Beardsley's face, turning her pale blue eyes to ice.
"He was chasing me," she said faintly.
"What?"
Jamie strode over to the ladder and, bending down, seized her by the arm, helping her, rather against her will, it seemed, to clamber up the rest of the way into the loft.
"What do you mean, chasing you?"
he demanded. She hunched her shoulders, looking round and homely as a cookie jar in her bundled shawls.
"He struck me," she said simply. "I came up the ladder to get away from him, but he followed. I tried to hide back there in the shadows, and he came. But then he fell, and he couldn't get up."
She shrugged again. Jamie held the candlestick near her face. She gave a small, nervous smile, eyes darting from me to Jamie, and I saw that the lisp was caused by the fact that her front teeth were broken, snapped off at an angle, just below the gums. A small scar ran through her upper lip. Another showed white in the hairs of one eyebrow. A horrible noise came from the man on the floor, a furious squeal of what sounded like protest. And she flinched, eyes shut tight in reflexive dread.
"Mm-hmm,"
Jamie said, glancing from her to her husband.
"Aye, well, fetch up some water, ma'am, and you will. Another candle, and some fresh rags as well," he called after her departing back as she hastened toward the ladder, only too glad to be given an excuse to leave.
"Jamie, bring back the light, will you?" He came and stood beside me, holding the candle so it shed its glow on the ruined body. He gave Beardsley a dark look of mingled pity and dislike and shook his head slowly.
"God's judgment, you think, Sassenach?"
"Not entirely God's, I don't think," I said, my voice lowered so as not to carry to the kitchen below.
I reached up and took the candlestick from him.
"Look."
A flask of water and a plate of bread, hard and tinged with blue mould, stood in the shadows near Beardsley's head, orts and bits of gluey, half-chewed bread covered the floor nearby. She had fed him, enough to keep him alive. Yet I had seen great quantities of food in that front room as we passed, hanging hams, barrels of dried fruit and salt fish and sauerkraut. There were bundles of furs, jugs of oil, piles of woolen blankets. And yet the master of those goods lay here in the dark, starved and shivering beneath a single sheet of linen.
"Why did you not just let him die, I wonder?"
Jamie asked softly, eyes fixed on the mouldy bread. Beardsley gargled and growled at this. His open eye rolled angrily, tears running down his face and snot bubbling from his nose. He flailed and grunted, arching his body in frustration, collapsing with a meaty thud that shook the boards of the loft.
"He can understand you, I think."
"Can you?" I addressed this remark to the sick man, who gobbled and drooled in a manner that made it clear that he understood at least that he was being spoken to.
"As to why?"
I gestured toward Beardsley's legs, moving the candle slowly above them. Some of the sores were indeed compression sores, caused by lying helpless for a long time. Others were not. Parallel slashes, clearly made by a knife, showed black and clotted on one massive thigh. The shin was decorated with a regular line of ulcerations, angry red wounds rimmed with black and oozing. Burns left to fester. Jamie gave a small grunt at the sight and glanced over his shoulder toward the ladder. The sound of a door opening came from below, and a cold draught blew up into the loft, making the candle flame dance wildly. The door shut, and the flame steadied.
"I can make shift to lure him, I think."
Jamie lifted the candle, assessing the beams overhead.
"A sling, perhaps, with a rope put over yon beam there. Is it all right to move him?"
"Yes," I said. But I wasn't paying attention. Bending over the sick man's legs, I had caught a whiff of something that I hadn't smelled in a long, long time. A very bad and sinister stink. I hadn't encountered it often, but even once would have been enough. The pungent smell of gas gangrene is strikingly memorable. I didn't want to say anything that might alarm Beardsley, if he was capable of understanding. So instead, I patted him reassuringly and stood up to go and fetch the candle from Jamie for a better look. He gave it to me, leaning close to murmur in my ear as he did so.
"Can you do aught for him, Sassenach?"
"No," I said, equally low-voiced.
"Not for the apoplexy, that is.
I can treat the sores and give him herbs against fever. That's all." He stood for a moment, looking at the humped figure in the shadows, now quiescent. Then he shook his head, crossed himself, and went quickly down the ladder to hunt a rope. I went slowly back to the sick man, who greeted me with a thick "Ah!" and a restless thumping of one leg like a rabbit's warning. I knelt by his feet, talking soothingly of nothing in particular, while I held the light close to examine them. The toes. All the toes on his dead foot had been burned. Some only blistered, others burned nearly to the bone. The first two toes had gone quite black, and a greenish tinge spread over the upper aspect of the foot nearby. I was appalled, as much by the thought of what might have led to this as by the action itself. The candle wavered. My hands were shaking, and not only with cold. I was not only horrified by what had happened here, I was also worried by the immediate prospects. What on earth were we to do about these wretched people? Plainly we couldn't take Beardsley with us. Just as plainly, he couldn't be left here under the care of his wife. There were no near neighbours to look in, no one else on the farm to safeguard him. I supposed we might manage to transport him to Brownsville. There might be a wagon in the barn. But even if so, what then? There was no hospital to care for him. If one of the homes in Brownsville might take him in for the sake of charity, well and good. But seeing Beardsley's state after a month, I thought it unlikely that his condition, in terms either of paralysis or speech, would improve much. Who would keep him if it meant caring for him day and night for the rest of his life? The rest of his life, of course, could be rather short, depending on my success in dealing with the gangrene. Worry retreated as my mind turned to the immediate problem. I would have to amputate. It was the only possibility. The toes were easy, but the toes might not be enough. If I had to take off the foot or part of it, we ran a greater risk from shock and infection. Could he feel it? Sometimes stroke victims retained feeling in an affected limb, but not movement. Sometimes movement without feeling. Sometimes neither. Cautiously, I touched the gangrenous toe, eyes on his face. His working eye was open, focused on the beams overhead. He didn't glance at me or make a noise, which answered that question. No, he couldn't feel the foot. That was a relief, in a way. At least he wouldn't suffer pain from the amputation. Nor, it occurred to me, had he felt the damage inflicted on his limb. Had she been aware of that? Or had she chosen to attack his dead side only because he retained some strength on the other and might still defend himself? There was a soft rustle behind me. Mrs. Beardsley was back. She set down a bucket of water and a pile of rags, then stood behind me, watching in silence as I began to sponge away the filth. "Can you cure him?" she asked. Her voice was calm, remote, as though she spoke of a stranger. The patient's head lolled suddenly back, so his open eye fixed on me. "I think I can help a bit," I said carefully. I wished Jamie would return. Aside from need of my medical box, I was finding the company of the Beardsleys rather unnerving. The more so when Mr. Beardsley inadvertently released a small quantity of urine. Mrs. Beardsley laughed, and he made a sound in reply that made the goosebumps rise on my arms. I wiped the liquid off his thigh and went on with my work, trying to ignore it. "Have you or Mr. Beardsley any kin nearby?" I asked as conversationally as possible. "Someone who might come in to lend you a hand?" "No one," she said. "He took me from my father's house in Maryland to this place." This place was spoken as though it were the fifth circle of hell. So far as I could see, there was certainly some resemblance at the present moment. The door opened below, and a welcome draught of cold air announced Jamie's return. There was a clunking noise as he set my box on the table, and I hastily rose, eager to escape them, if only for a moment. "There's my husband with my medicines. I'll just, go and fetch, I edged past Mrs. Beardsley's bulk and fled down the ladder, sweating in spite of the chill in the house. Jamie stood by the table, frowning as he turned a length of rope in his hands. He glanced up as he heard me, and his face relaxed a little. "How is it, Sassenach?" he asked, low-voiced, with a jerk of the chin toward the loft. "Very bad," I whispered, coming to stand beside him. "Two of his toes are gangrenous. I'll have to take them off. And she says they've no family near to help." His lips tightened, and he bent his attention to the sling he was improvising. I reached for my medical chest to check my instruments, but stopped when I saw Jamie's pistols lying on the table beside it, along with his powder horn and shot case. I touched his arm and jerked my head at them, mouthing, "What?" at him. The line between his brows deepened, but before he could answer, a dreadful racket came from the loft above, a great thrashing and thumping, accompanied by a gargling noise like an elephant drowning in a mud bog. Jamie dropped the rope and shot for the ladder with me at his heels. He let out a shout as his head topped the ladder and dived forward. As I scrambled into the loft behind him, I saw him in the shadows grappling with Mrs. Beardsley. She smashed an elbow at his face, hitting him in the nose. This removed any inhibitions he might have had about manhandling a woman, and he jerked her round to face him and struck her with a short, sharp uppercut to the chin that clicked her jaws and made her stagger, eyes glazing. I dashed forward to save the candle as she collapsed on her rump in a poof of skirts and petticoats.
God damn that woman!
Jamie's voice was muffled, his sleeve pressed across his face to staunch the flow of blood from his nose, but the sincerity in it was unmistakable. Mr. Beardsley was flopping like a landed fish, wheezing and gurgling. I lifted the candle and found him flailing at his neck with one splayed hand. A linen kerchief had been twisted into a rope and wrapped round his neck, and his face was black, his one eye popping. I hastily seized the kerchief and undid it, and his breathing eased with a great whoosh of fetid air.
If she'd been faster, she'd have had him.
Jamie lowered his blood-streaked arm and felt his nose tenderly.
Christ! I think she broke my nose.
Why? Why did you stop me?
Mrs. Beardsley was still conscious, though swaying and glassy-eyed.
He should die. I want him to die. He must die.
And me and Nagala. You could have killed him at your leisure any time this month passed if you'd wanted him dead,
Jamie said impatiently.
Why in God's name wait until you had witnesses?
She looked up at him, eyes suddenly sharp and clear.
I didn't want him dead, she said. I wanted him to die.
She smiled, showing the stubs of her broken teeth.
Slowly.
Oh, Christ, I said, and wiped a hand across my face. It was only mid-morning, but I felt as though the day had lasted several weeks already. It's my fault. I told her I thought I could help. She thought I'd save him, maybe cure him altogether. The curse of a reputation for magic healing. I might have laughed had I been in the mood for irony. There was a sharp, fresh stink in the air, and Mrs. Beardsley turned on her husband with a cry of outrage.
Filthy beast!
She scrambled to her knees, snatched up a hard roll from the plate and threw it at him. It bounced off his head.
Filthy, stinking, dirty, wicked!
Jamie seized her by the hair as she hurled herself at the prone body, grabbed her arm, and jerked her away, sobbing and shrieking abuse.
Bloody hell, he said over the uproar. Fetch me that rope, Sassenach, before I kill them both myself.
The job of getting Mr. Beardsley down from the loft was enough to leave both Jamie and me sweat-soaked and streaked with filth, reeking and weak in the knees with effort. Mrs. Beardsley squatted on a stool in the corner, quiet and malevolent as a toad, making no effort to help. She gave a gasp of outrage when we laid the big, lolling body on the clean table, but Jamie glared at her, and she sank back on her stool, mouth clamped to a thin, straight line. Jamie wiped his blood-stained sleeve across his brow and shook his head as he looked at Beardsley. I didn't blame him. Even cleaned up, warmly covered, and with a little warm gruel spooned into him, the man was in a dreadful state. I examined him once more, carefully, in the light from the window. No doubt about the toes. The stink of gangrene was distinct, and the greenish tinge covered the outer dorsal aspect of the foot.
I'd have to take more than the toes.
I frowned, feeling my way carefully around the putrefying area, wondering whether it was better to try for a partial amputation between the metacarpals, or simply to take the foot off at the ankle. The ankle dissection would be faster, and while I would normally try for the more conservative partial amputation, there was really no point to it in this case. Beardsley was plainly never going to walk again. I gnawed my lower lip dubiously. For that matter, the whole business might be moot. He burned with intermittent fever, and the sores on legs and buttocks oozed with suppuration. What were the chances of his recovering from the amputation without dying of infection? I hadn't heard Mrs. Beardsley come up behind me. For a heavy-set woman, she moved with remarkable silence.
"What do you mean to do?"
she asked, her voice sounding neutral and remote.
"Your husband's toes are gangrenous," I said.
No point in trying not to alarm Beardsley now. "I'll have to amputate his foot." There was really no choice, though my heart sank at the notion of spending the next several days, or weeks, here, nursing Beardsley. I could hardly leave him to the tender care of his wife. She circled the table slowly, coming to a stop near his feet. Her face was blank, but a tiny smile appeared at the corners of her mouth, winking on and off, as though quite without her willing it. She looked at the blackened toes for a long minute, then shook her head.
"No," she said softly. "Let him rot."
The question of Beardsley's understanding was resolved, at least. His open eye bulged, and he let out a shriek of rage, thrashing and flailing in an effort to get at her, so that he came perilously near to falling onto the floor in his struggles. Jamie seized him, shoving and heaving to keep his ponderous bulk on the table. As Beardsley at last subsided, gasping and making mewling noises, Jamie straightened up, gasping himself, and gave Mrs. Beardsley a look of extreme dislike. She hunched her shoulders, pulling her shawl tight around them, but didn't retreat or look away. She raised her chin defiantly.
"I am his wife," she said. "I shall not let you cut him. It is a risk to his life."
"It's certain death if I don't," I said shortly. "And a nasty one, too. You..." I didn't get to finish. Jamie put a hand on my shoulder, squeezing hard.
"Take her outside, Claire,"
he said quietly. "But..."
"Outside."
His hand tightened on my shoulder, almost painful in its pressure.
"Then I come back until I call for you."
His face was grim, but there was something in his eyes that made me go hollow and watery inside. I glanced at the sideboard where his pistols lay beside my medicine chest, then back at his face, appalled.
"You can't," I said.
He looked at Beardsley, his face bleak.
"I would put down a dog in such a case without a second's thought," he said softly. "Can I do less for him?"
"He isn't a dog."
"No, he is not."
His hand dropped from my shoulder, and he circled the table until he stood by Beardsley's side.
"If you understand me, man, close your eye," he said quietly.
There was a moment's silence, and Beardsley's bloodshot eye fixed on Jamie's face with undeniable intelligence. The lid closed slowly, then rose again. Jamie turned to me.
"Go," he said. "Let it be his choice. If, or if not, I will call for you."
My knees were trembling, and I knotted my hands in the folds of my skirt.
"No,"
I said. I looked at Beardsley, then swallowed hard and shook my head.
"No,"
I said again.
If you must have a witness."
He hesitated a moment, but then nodded.
"Aye, you're right."
He glanced at Mrs. Beardsley. She stood stock still, hands knotted under her apron, eyes darting from me to Jamie to her husband and back. Jamie shook his head briefly, then turned back to the stricken man, squaring his shoulders.
"Blink once for yes, twice for nay," he said. "You understand?"
The eyelid lowered without hesitation.
"Listen, then."
Jamie drew a deep breath and began to speak in a flat, unemotional tone of voice, his eyes steady on the ruined face and the fierce gaze of its open eye.
"You ken what has happened to you?"
Blink.
"You ken that my wife is a physician, a healer?"
The eye rolled in my direction, then back to Jamie.
Blink. "She says that you've suffered an apoplexy, that the damage cannot be mended. You understand?"
A huffing sound came from the lopsided mouth. This was not news.
Blink. "Your foot is putrid. If it is not taken off, you will rot and die. You understand?"
No response. The nostrils flared suddenly, moist, questing. Then the air was expelled with a snort. He had smelled the rot, had suspected perhaps, but not known for sure that it came from his own flesh. Not till now. Slowly, a blink. The quiet litany went on, statements and questions, each a shovelful of dirt taken from a deepening grave, each ending with the inexorable words, "You understand." My hands and feet and face felt numb. The odd sense of sanctuary in the room had altered. It felt like a church, but no longer a place of refuge. A place now in which some ritual took place, leading to a solemn, predestined end. And it was predestined, I understood. Beardsley had made his choice long since, perhaps even before we arrived. He had had a month in that purgatory, after all, suspended in the cold dark between heaven and earth, in which to think, to come to grips with his prospects, and make his peace with death. Did he understand? Oh, yes, very well. Jamie bent over the table, one hand on Beardsley's arm, a priest in stained linen, offering absolution and salvation. Mrs. Beardsley stood frozen in the fall of light from the window, a stolid angel of denunciation. The statements and the questions came to an end. "Will you have my wife take your foot and tend your wounds?" One blink. Then two. Exaggerated, deliberate. Jamie's breathing was audible, the heaviness in his chest making a sigh of each word. "Do you ask me to take your life?" Though one half of his face sagged lifeless, and the other was drawn and haggard, there was enough of Beardsley left to show expression. The workable corner of the mouth turned up in a cynical leer.
"What there is left of it," said his silence.
The eyelid fell and stayed shut. Jamie closed his own eyes. A small shudder passed over him. Then he shook himself briefly, like a man shaking off cold water, and turned to the sideboard where his pistols lay. I crossed swiftly to him, laying a hand on his arm. He didn't look at me, but kept his eyes on the pistol he was priming. His face was white, but his hands were steady.
"Go," he said. "Take her out."
I looked back at Beardsley, but he was my patient no longer, his flesh beyond my healing or my comfort. I went to the woman and took her by the arm, turning her toward the door. She came with me, walking mechanically, and didn't turn to look back.
This ends Disc 14. The Fiery Cross, Disc 15.
The outdoors seemed unreal, the sunlit yard unconvincingly ordinary. Mrs. Beardsley pulled free of my grip and headed toward the barn, walking fast. She glanced back over her shoulder at the house, then broke into a heavy run, disappearing through the open barn door as though fiends were after her. I caught her sense of panic and nearly ran after her. I didn't, though. I stopped at the edge of the yard and waited. I could feel my heart beating, slowly, thumping in my ears. That seemed unreal, too. The shot came, finally. A small, flat sound, inconsequent amid the soft bleating of goats from the barn, and the rustle of chickens scratching in the dirt nearby. Head, I wondered suddenly, or heart? And shuddered. It was long past noon. The cold, still air of the morning had risen, and a chilly breeze moved through the dooryard, stirring dust and wisps of hay. I stood and waited. He would have paused, I thought, to say a brief prayer for Beardsley's soul. A moment passed, two. Then the back door opened. Jamie came out, took a few steps, then stopped, bent over, and vomited. I started forward in case he needed me, but no. He straightened and wiped his mouth, then turned and walked across the yard away from me, heading for the wood. I felt suddenly superfluous and rather oddly affronted. I'd been at work no more than moments before, deeply absorbed in the practice of medicine, connected to flesh, to mind and body, attentive to symptoms, aware of pulse and breath, the vital signs. I hadn't liked Beardsley in the least. And yet I'd been totally engaged in the struggle to preserve his life, to ease his suffering.
I could still feel the odd touch of his slack, warm flesh on my hands.
Now my patient was abruptly dead, and I felt as though some small part of my body had been amputated. I thought I was perhaps a trifle shocked.
I glanced at the house, my original sense of caution superseded by distaste. And something deeper. The body must be washed, of course, and decently laid out for burial. I had done such things before, with no great qualms, if without enthusiasm, and yet I found myself now with a great reluctance to go back into the place. I had seen death by violence, and many much more distasteful than this was likely to have been. Death was death, whether it came as passage, as parting, or in some cases as dearly desired release. Jamie had freed Beardsley very suddenly from the prison of his stricken body. Did his spirit perhaps still linger in the house, having not yet realised its freedom? "You're being superstitious, Beecham," I said severely to myself. "Stop it at once." And yet I didn't take a step toward the house, but hovered in the yard, keyed up like an indecisive hummingbird. If Beardsley was beyond my help, and Jamie in no need of it, there was still one who might require it. I turned my back on the house and went toward the barn. This was no more than a large open shed with a loft, fragrantly dark and filled with hay and moving shapes. I stood in the doorway until my eyes adjusted. There was a stall in one corner, but no horse. A rickety fence with a milking stanchion made a goat pen in the other corner. She was crouched inside it, on a pile of fresh straw. Half a dozen goats crowded and bumped around her, jostling and nibbling at the fringes of her shawl. She was little more than a hunched shape, but I caught the brief shine of a wary eye in the shadows.
"Is it over?"
The question was asked softly, barely audible above the quiet grunting and bleating.
"Yes."
I hesitated, but she seemed in no need of my support. I could see better now. She had a small kid curled in her lap, her fingers stroking the small, silky head.
"Are you quite all right, Mrs. Beardsley?"
Silence. Then the heavy figure shrugged and settled, some tension seeming to leave her.
"I scarcely know," she said softly.
I waited, but she neither moved nor spoke further. The peaceful company of the goat seemed as likely as mine to be a comfort to her, so I turned and left them, rather envying her the warm refuge of the barn and her cheerful companions. We had left the horses in the dooryard, still saddled, tethered to an alder sapling. Jamie had loosened their girths and removed their saddlebags when he went to fetch my medicine box, but hadn't taken the time to unsaddle them. I did that now. Plainly it would be some time yet before we could leave. I took off the bridles as well and hobbled them, turning them loose to graze on the winter brown grass that still grew thickly at the edge of the pines. There was a hollowed half log on the western side of the house, plainly meant to serve as a horse trough, but it was empty. Welcoming the chore for the delay it allowed me, I raised water from the well and emptied bucket after bucket into the trough. Wiping my wet hands on my skirt, I looked round for further useful occupation, but there wasn't any.
No choice, then.
I braced myself, poured more water into the bucket, dropped in the hollow drinking gourd that stood on the edge of the well, and carried it back around the house, concentrating fiercely on not spilling any, in order to avoid thinking about the prospects within. When I raised my eyes, I was startled to see that the back door stood open. I was sure it had been closed before. Was Jamie inside? Or Mrs. Beardsley? Keeping a wary distance, I craned my neck to peep into the kitchen. But as I sidled closer, I heard the steady chuff of a spade shifting dirt. I went around the far corner to find Jamie digging near a mountain ash tree that stood by itself in the yard, a short distance from the house. He was still in shirt sleeves, and the wind blew the stained white linen against his body, ruffling the red hair over his face.
He brushed it back with one wrist, and I saw with a small sense of shock that he was crying. He wept silently and somehow savagely, attacking the soil as though it were an enemy. He caught my movement from a corner of his eye and stopped, swiping a blood-smeared shirt sleeve quickly across his face as though to wipe away sweat from his brow. He was breathing hoarsely, loud enough to hear from a distance. I came silently and offered him the gourd of water along with a clean handkerchief. He didn't meet my eyes, but drank, coughed, drank again, handed back the gourd, and blew his nose gingerly. It was swollen, but no longer bleeding. "We won't sleep here tonight, will we?" I ventured to ask, seating myself on the chopping block that stood under the ash tree. He shook his head.
"God, no,"
he said hoarsely. His face was blotched and his eyes bloodshot, but he had firm hold of himself.
"We'll see him decently buried and go. I dinna mind if we sleep cold in the wood again, but not here."
I agreed wholeheartedly with that notion, but there was one thing more to be considered.
"And her?" I asked delicately. "Is she in the house? The back door is open."
He grunted and thrust in his shovel.
"No, that was me. I'd forgot to leave it open when I came out before. To let the soul go free,"
he explained, seeing my upraised eyebrow. It was the complete matter-of-factness with which he offered this explanation, rather than the fact that it echoed my own earlier notion, that made the hairs prickle along my neck.
"I see," I said, a little faintly.
Jamie dug steadily for a bit, the shovel biting deep into the dirt. It was loamy soil and leaf mould here. The digging was easy. At last, without breaking the swing of the blade, he said,
"Brianna told me a story she'd read once. I dinna recall all about it, quite. But there was a murder done. Only the person killed was a wicked man who had driven someone to it. And at the end, when the teller of the tale was asked what should be done, he said, 'Let pass the justice of God.'"
I nodded. I was in agreement, though it seemed a trifle hard on the person who found himself required to be the instrument of such justice.
"Do you suppose that's what it was in this case? Justice?"
He shook his head, not in negation, but in puzzlement, and went on digging. I watched him for a bit, soothed by his nearness and by the hypnotic rhythm of his movements. After a bit, though, I stirred, steeling myself to face the task awaiting me. "I suppose I'd best go and lay out the body and clear up the loft," I said, reluctantly drawing my feet under me to rise. "We can't leave that poor woman alone with such a mess, no matter what she did."
"No, wait, Sassenach,"
Jamie said, pausing in his digging. He glanced at the house a little warily.
"I'll go in with you, in a bit.
For now," he nodded toward the edge of the wood.
"Do you think you could fetch a few stones for the cairn?"
"A cairn?" I was more than slightly surprised at this. It seemed an unnecessary elaboration for the late Mr. Beardsley. Still, there were undoubtedly wolves in the wood. I'd seen scats on the trail 2 days before. It also occurred to me that Jamie might be contriving an honourable excuse for me to postpone entering the house again, in which case hauling rocks seemed a thoroughly desirable alternative. Fortunately, there was no shortage of suitable rocks. I fetched the heavy canvas apron that I wore for surgery from my saddlebag and began to trundle to and fro, an ant collecting laborious crumbs. After half an hour or so of this, the thought of entering the house had begun to seem much less objectionable. Jamie was still hard at it, though, so I kept on. I stopped finally, gasping, and dumped yet another load out of my apron onto the ground by the deepening grave. The shadows were falling long across the dooryard, and the air was cold enough that my fingers had gone numb. A good thing, in view of the various scrapes and nicks on them.
"You look a right mess," I observed, shoving a dishevelled mass of hair off my own face. "Has Mrs. Beardsley come out yet?"